Hey there. Before we get into today's episode, I have a quick favor to ask. If you love the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. It helps other people find us and it helps us know what you're liking and want to hear more of. Thank you. On with the show. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, what abortion bans have meant for women in America. Earlier this year, a woman named Kristen went to an abortion clinic outside of Fort Lauderdale in Florida. Kristen already had two kids, and she'd gotten pregnant again unexpectedly.
She didn't have the resources for it and wanted to be a good mom to the kids that she already had. So she came in and was expecting to end this pregnancy.
Kristen was 8 weeks pregnant. And she thought she'd gone to the clinic just in time, the day before Florida's six-week abortion ban took effect. But Florida law requires at least 24 hours between an initial consultation and an abortion procedure, which meant she had missed the deadline by one day.
And I sat just like a foot away from her as she internalized that news, and she just started to sob. I mean, the tears just were rolling down her cheeks. And she just said, no, 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 no.
Kristen is just one of thousands of women who've been denied abortions since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. And the person telling her story is Caroline Kitchener with The Washington Post. She's been crisscrossing the country, reporting the human stories behind the fall of abortion rights in America. Last year, she won a Pulitzer Prize for her work on this issue. Part of the reason why I wanted to speak with Caroline is because so often abortion is talked about and reported on as a political issue. And Caroline's reporting stands out for centering it as fundamentally a healthcare issue and a deeply personal one. She started by telling me about her trip to Florida on the day before the state's six-week ban went into effect.
That day in Florida, I'll remember it for the rest of my life. They allowed me to sort of sit there with some of their counselors as they broke the news to women that they would not be able to get abortions there. And this clinic was very, they wanted to be very helpful to these women. They wanted to, you know, convey to them that although they would not be able to offer them services in that clinic that day because of the new ban in Florida, they could help them travel to another state mm-hmm. or find some other way to get an abortion. And what really struck me that day was, I mean, this clinic was giving all the resources it possibly could give. They literally were saying, you know, we can help you get plane tickets. There's abortion funds. Don't worry about money. Like, we can help you figure that out. But these women were still looking at these counselors like they were suggesting that they go to the moon. You know, it was like, what? Like, I have to go to DC? I have kids I have to take care of. I have a job. Like, how would I even, you know, I think some of these women had never even been on a plane. You know, they just sort of had this look in their eye, like, how is that even possible?
Yeah, like the funding is just one of the hurdles to all of this.
Exactly. Funding is just one of the hurdles. And I would say that came through so strongly that day. And I do think that that's something that a lot of people don't appreciate about these bans is that it's, for a lot of people, it's not just a matter of hours in the car and getting together the money. There are other complicating circumstances in life that would prevent someone often from making that kind of trip.
So the woman that you met, Kristen, who was denied an abortion at that clinic, did you keep in touch with her? Do you know what happened to her?
You know, I tried to. I obviously had her number and I texted her a few times and I didn't hear back. But sometimes when people don't respond, I do later find out that they just decided to carry the pregnancy and they just are moving on.
Yeah.
And they're just living with it.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what happened in her case, but I do think about her and I wonder about that.
Yeah. Now, the number of self-managed abortions has risen dramatically since Roe v. Wade was overturned. And you wrote a piece earlier this year that followed women who had chosen to end their pregnancies on their own. using abortion pills that they obtained online. Can you tell us a few of their stories and what they were able to tell you about their experiences?
So I talked to a lot of women who went this route and got pills mostly online and then took them at home alone in states with abortion bans. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to say right off talking about this kind of abortion care is that abortion pills are extremely safe. We know that this is a form of medication with, you know, extremely few complications. But the thing that came up in these interviews was fear. And I think that fear is so much more intense when you are doing this thing that, you know, it's a medical thing and you are doing it on your own. And you're also not just doing it on your own. It's that in these states with bans, these women didn't feel like they had anybody they could turn to. They didn't feel like they could call a doctor or even, you know, go to the hospital if they were unsure if the amount of bleeding that they had was normal, right? They felt like, almost overwhelmingly, almost everybody that I talked to felt like if they reached out for help or even with a question about what was normal, they could go to jail.
Mm. That was the fear, just to name it exactly.
That was the fear.
Going to jail for this, yeah. And just to say, to speak to this idea of fear, I mean, the laws that are in place right now, abortion bans in certain states, don't allow people seeking abortions to be prosecuted. But the fact that you heard fear from so many people, I think, speaks to the uncertainty of this moment for so many people.
I'm really glad you made that point, because it is true. Under these laws, you can't be prosecuted. Now, I will say that there are other laws that have been used and are currently being used to prosecute women. These kinds of prosecutions typically happen when a woman is farther along in her pregnancy, but it can be things like concealing a corpse or child abuse or, you know, various other things that will allow a particularly zealous district attorney to punish the woman. I just want to note that those things do happen.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
For women in states with bans who are not, you know, tracking this super closely, I think the majority of people that I talked to just sort of vaguely knew, okay, this is illegal. I'm doing something illegal. I'm going to be able to get these pills, but it feels shady. A word that I heard a lot was legit. Like, I don't know, are these websites legit? Are these pills going to be real? And we know that they are. The organizations that are mailing these pills, they are legit. The biggest ones do have kind of doctors working with them and prescribing them. But it just doesn't feel super safe sometimes, I think, for people in banned states who know that this is illegal. So yeah. I think that's something that people are really wrestling with. And while some would say that it is very easy to get these pills shipped to you, the experience is not what everybody wants. For some people, it's even better than going to a clinic, ordering pills online and taking them at home fully independently. But it's not something that feels right for everybody.
The decision to take abortion pills did feel right for a 34-year-old woman named Brianna. Last year, when she found out she was pregnant, Brianna was already 11 or 12 weeks along. She was struggling to care for the kids she already had, so she looked into having a surgical abortion. But she lived in Alabama, a state where abortion is banned in almost all circumstances. The closest appointment she could get was 6 hours away in a different state, and the clinic was booked for over a month.
So she goes online, and she starts looking around, and she finds she can order abortion pills from an organization called Aid Access, which is by far the largest organization that is doing this kind of work. It's based in Europe, but they work with licensed doctors in the United States.
By the time Brianna gets the pills, she thinks she's about 15 to 16 weeks pregnant, outside the 10-week window recommended by the FDA and the doctors at Aid Access. But Brianna felt she had no other choice.
She takes them, and first of all, it's a lot more painful than she was expecting.
She has full body chills and contractions that she says were more painful than what she remembered from giving birth.
And then the fetus comes out and she can see a lot more than she was expecting to see. And the placenta actually gets stuck and it won't fully come out.
And she has no idea what to do.
She knows that this is a problem, a really big problem. And if abortion was not banned in Alabama, she would be going to that emergency room and getting care from a licensed medical professional. But she doesn't feel like she can do that because it's banned and she's afraid that she's going to go to jail.
Brianna eventually calls the miscarriage and abortion hotline.
And they are kind of counseling her on what to do. Deep breaths, pushing, you know, just really trying to walk her through doing this on her own.
After about 15 minutes, the placenta comes out.
It worked, the abortion worked, but it was one of the most terrifying experiences of her life.
Caroline spoke with several OBGYNs who said that a woman in this situation is in serious danger of hemorrhaging or becoming septic. But a doctor from the hotline told Caroline that they didn't feel Brianna's case would be considered a medical emergency. Even though the situation was extremely scary and difficult for Brianna, she told Caroline that she was grateful for aid access and for the hotline.
The miscarriage and abortion hotline, it was an invaluable resource to her at the time, but I think it really says a lot about where we are with abortion in this country, that she had to rely on this kind of disembodied voice that she didn't even know at this really critical, scary moment.
When Caroline checked in with Brianna a year later, she said she was sure she made the right decision to end that pregnancy. She just wishes that she'd had more information about what to expect, and that if she had known more, she might have tried harder to find an out-of-state clinic. But one thing is for sure, before the overturning of Roe v. Wade, there was a clinic less than 30 minutes from Brianna's house. I asked Caroline to tell me one more story from her reporting about a 25-year-old woman in Texas named Kelsey Norris De La Cruz. She had an ectopic pregnancy. That's when an embryo implants and grows outside of the uterus. In situations like this, the pregnancy is non-viable, and if left untreated, it can be deadly for the mother. Now, even though abortion is almost entirely banned in Texas, the law explicitly allows doctors to treat ectopic pregnancies. But doctors at a Texas hospital refused to treat Norris De La Cruz and told her to go home and wait.
She knew this is an emergency, and she knew enough about the laws to know that under the laws, you still could treat a woman in a medical emergency.
Mm-hmm.
But still, they turned her away. And so she calls her best friend when she leaves the hospital, and her best friend is, you know, obviously also outraged. And she says, you know what? I have an appointment with my OBGYN today. I'm going to ask them about this. And she does. And the doctors say, bring your friend in today. Mm. Tell your friend to come today. So she goes in to a, you know, OBGYN she's never met with before. It's just her, you know, best friend's doctor. And that doctor says, you need to have surgery today and I'm going to do it. So, you know, by the time that she got into that surgery, the medical records show, and I also spoke with the doctor in the case, the pregnancy had already started to rupture. And once that happens, women die that way. It can be very quick. It's extremely dangerous. And so she is okay. And, you know, it worked out. She was able to get the treatment that she needed. But you just have to wonder what would have happened if her friend hadn't had that appointment and she hadn't been able to get care from somebody else. I think that an important thing to point out is that, you know, these laws, they have exceptions, all of them, some version of an exception for either the life or health of the mother. A lot of them use the term medical emergency, but it's really hard, I think, for doctors to know what constitutes a medical emergency, right? At what point does it become that urgent that they can kind of qualify for this exception? Because you have to feel for the doctors too, because, you know, they're concerned about their lives and their livelihoods and their families and going to jail. You know, in Texas, you could go to jail.
Yeah.
So, you know, they are having to make these calculations in these very high pressure situations, and it's difficult for them too. And so they really struggle with this kind of vague language.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there have been a few studies since Roe v. Wade was overturned on this idea of moral distress in the medical community, right? One study found 96% of providers who care for pregnant women in states with restrictive laws reported feeling some amount of moral distress in their jobs. In a survey of OBGYNs who mostly were not abortion providers, more than 90% of them said the laws had prevented them or their colleagues from providing what they consider standard medical care.
Yeah.
It's clear that this is having an enormous effect on medical professionals. And I also appreciate how you write that many hospitals are failing to issue policy or guidance, which essentially protects them as an institution, but leaves these providers individually vulnerable, right? Individually having to interpret the law for themselves and decide whether they want to put themselves in a terrible position.
I think that's a piece of this that has really flown under the radar, is the role that hospitals have to play. We hear a lot about the doctors, but the hospital is the big institution, right? Mm-hmm. The hospital can make policies. I've spoken with a lot of doctors that work at hospitals that have really good, robust policies for what to do. There are certain conditions that are relatively common where these kinds of questions come up. Can we treat this? Can we not? And when the hospital comes out to say, yes, we have decided as an institution, our lawyers have decided as an institution, we can treat these cases. It's just an enormous amount of relief for the doctor. Like, they know, okay, when we see that, we know we can act. And I've also spoken with a lot of doctors who work at hospitals that have no policy and are sort of throwing their hands up in the air and saying, you know, actually, we want to trust the doctor. We want to trust your discretion. But, you know, almost everybody that I talk to, the doctors don't want that because that is just, I think they would say, just an unfair amount of pressure to put on their shoulders.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to talk about politics and how this is factoring into the election in November and conversations about November. I mean, so much has changed with Vice President Kamala Harris now at the top of the Democratic ticket. She's a vocal supporter of abortion rights. She has spoken about it very differently than President Biden has. What has changed with Harris now in the race?
Oh, everything has changed. I think it's hard to imagine a worse Democratic spokesperson for abortion than Joe Biden was. I mean, during the debate especially, the things that Biden said about abortion made no sense.
Look, there's so many young women who have been, including a young woman who just was murdered, and he went to the funeral. The idea that she was murdered by an immigrant coming in, they talk about that. But here's the deal: there's a lot of young women who are being raped by their in-laws, by their spouses, brothers and sisters, it's just ridiculous, and they can do nothing about it. And they try to arrest them when they cross state lines.
Thank you.
Everybody was so, on the Democratic side, was so frustrated by that because this is, you know, many would say, the best issue for Democrats. Mm. Now, I think we saw such a difference when we saw Kamala Harris talking about this during the debate. She, you know, not only was very clear and informative about, you know, what these bans are doing, she used really concrete and specific examples and language to illustrate, you know, women bleeding out in a car.
I have talked with women around our country. You want to talk about this is what people wanted? Pregnant women who want to carry a pregnancy to term, suffering from a miscarriage, being denied care in an emergency room because the healthcare providers are afraid they might go to jail, and she's bleeding out in a car in the parking lot? She didn't want that. Her husband didn't want that? A 12 or 13-year-old survivor of incest being forced to carry a pregnancy to term? They don't want that.
She really painted a picture of what medical care can be for women in a post-Roe era.
Mm. And I know some Republicans have criticized that exact line, actually, saying, oh, women aren't bleeding out in parking lots. But, I mean, you've done this reporting. You've talked to women all over. Is this happening?
Well, we have not heard a story about a woman actually dying in a parking lot. That is true. But we have heard examples of women being forced to wait in parking lots until their situation worsens for them to be able to get care.
Yeah. Come back in when it's life-threatening,
right,
basically.
Right, right.
Yeah. Let's talk now about President Trump. He appointed three Supreme Court justices that allowed for the overturning of Roe v. Wade. In this election, though, he is mostly saying that abortion access and rights should fall to the states to decide. You recently wrote about how he seems to be contradicting himself a lot, how he seems to be searching for a winning message on abortion. What do you make about how he's been talking about this issue?
The flip-flopping has been really, really remarkable in the past couple of weeks, although I have to say, not entirely surprising. He's really been contorting himself to try to both appeal to independents and moderates who he knows support abortion rights while not alienating his base that is very excited that Roe v. Wade is overturned. So you really see him walking this very, very fine line trying to navigate between those two things in a way that allows him to speak to the moderate voters he really wants to get on this issue who might be turned off by what he's done in the past while maintaining the base. So I think the most striking example that you saw on that was, you know, his kind of 24-hour clear flip-flop on the Florida ballot initiative that is designed to protect abortion rights in the Florida Constitution until the point of viability. He was asked whether he was planning to vote for that ballot initiative that would protect abortion rights in Florida. And he said that he felt that 6 weeks, which is the point at which Florida now bans abortion, 6 weeks was too short.
Well, I think the 6 week is too short. It has to be more time. And so that's, and I've told them that I want more weeks.
So you'll vote in favor of the amendment?
I am going to be voting that we need more than 6 weeks.
And then 24 hours later, after you saw the anti-abortion world just go nuts at the suggestion that Donald Trump might vote for this ballot initiative, you saw him come out and say, I will not be voting for this. This is too extreme.
The Democrats are radical because the 9 months is just a ridiculous situation that where you can do an abortion in the ninth month. And, you know, some of the states like Minnesota and other states have it where you could actually execute the baby after birth. And all of that stuff is unacceptable. So I'll be voting no for that reason.
You saw him say something that he's said quite a few times, including at the debate, suggesting that the Florida initiative promoted abortions until the ninth month of pregnancy, which is not true. It protects abortion access until the point of viability, which is typically around 24 weeks of pregnancy, unless there is a, you know, severe risk to the mother's health. So all of that said, it was a pretty clear backtrack, and I think just really highlighted how difficult it has been for him to navigate this issue, knowing how popular abortion rights are and knowing that he is really responsible for appointing the justices that overturned Roe.
Yeah. There was one thing that he said in the debate where he repeated the false claim that Democrats have supported abortion after birth. And
totally
this
false
idea of executing babies. Yes, totally false. But when you trace it back to maybe its roots, he is referencing something that is real, which is palliative care for newborns who are born with some kind of terminal illness. Can you explain what might be at the center of this that is true, that he is falsely now making a connection to abortion?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing that we should say is that it is illegal in all 50 states to execute a baby. That is murder. No one is questioning that. He is deploying what has become, I would say, the leading strategy of anti-abortion activists in responding to this wave of support for abortion rights. They used these arguments before Roe fell, but you hear it all the time. This stress on abortions that happen later in pregnancy. The numbers of those cases are just so, so tiny. That is, you know, one thing to know. And the other thing to know is that when those cases do happen later in pregnancy, it is almost always because there is either a severe risk to the life of the mother or because there is a severe fetal anomaly. So all of that aside, you asked about palliative care. And yes, there is, you know, a kind of very rare circumstance where a baby is born with some kind of severe fetal anomaly. They're not going to live. And the doctor is not going to try to move heaven and earth to just make them live a few minutes longer, right? The family has made the choice that they want to make the baby as comfortable as possible. They want to be as comfortable as possible. And that is the choice that they've made. But again, these cases are so rare. And of course, what I'm describing there, it's just not what Trump is saying, right?
Yeah.
He is talking about murder. And palliative care is not that.
I mean, thinking about how Trump is talking about abortion more broadly, I know you called it a fine line, but is there even a line to be walked here that can actually effectively balance all these competing forces?
I really think that's one of the central questions of the election. It's certainly the question that I'm most interested in. I will say that I have been reaching out to as many pro-choice Republican women as I can, trying to find women who are wrestling with this question, who are naturally inclined to support Trump, but who care deeply about abortion rights. I'm very interested in whether those people are buying what he's saying or how they're responding to what he's saying about abortion. And I will tell you that kind of overwhelmingly, this is obviously anecdotal, but the people that I'm talking to, they actually don't believe that he cares about this issue very much. So they're not really concerned. They're overwhelmingly not concerned that he's going to do more to restrict abortion access. Like, they kind of laugh at that question. Like, of course he's not going to. Like, he knows this is a losing issue. I've had a few people tell me that they think that Trump is actually pro-choice, which is interesting. I mean, he has said that in the past a long time ago. I, of course, press them on the fact that he has claimed responsibility for overturning Roe, and they, you know, I think people kind of struggle with what to say to that. But I don't know. I don't know whether he is going to be able to persuade people that care about abortion rights that he is not something to worry about on that front.
Right.
I don't know. I think we'll see.
Yeah.
I'll add one more thing there. Mm-hmm. When you talk to some of the leading anti-abortion groups, they'll tell me that they are not as concerned with the things that Trump is saying about abortion now that are really backtracking, because they are still betting on the fact that he will appoint a pro-life person to lead HHS, to lead DOJ. Mm-hmm. And if he has those people in place that are, you know, true believers on this issue and are very pro-life and care about enacting pro-life policies, they sort of feel like it's maybe not that important what Trump himself feels or says, right? As long as he puts those people in place. And I do think that's a piece of this that is getting lost a little bit, is the power that he has to pick that person and then the influence that that person and the people that work for them will have.
Yeah, sort of like the Supreme Court nominee effect, basically, right?
Yeah.
He can put people in place to make certain choices.
Yeah.
Abortion rights has been on the ballot in a number of states already. And what we have seen happen is a lot of voters choosing to support abortion access in their state. Again, this November, we're going to see abortion on the ballot in 10 states. This has been Trump's line, is that it should be sent back to the states. Is sending it back to the states to decide sort of backfiring for Republicans who want to see abortion access limited?
Well, I certainly think that the vast majority of anti-abortion Republicans did not anticipate the degree of public support for abortion rights. And I think it was really after Kansas. Kansas was the first state to have a vote directly on abortion. And after that, you really saw them realize, okay, this is something that a lot of states could do. And you also saw them trying to maneuver to keep it off the ballot in a variety of different ways. Mm. So yeah, I mean, I do think a lot of people saw the writing on the wall quite quickly. You know, ballot initiatives, though, they are not going to restore things to the way that they were before Roe v. Wade. A big reason for that is that in certain states, it's really hard to get something on a ballot. So Texas, for example, like, you just can't do it without the legislature. And you're talking about a really, really big state there and a state where a ballot initiative is just not going to be a way forward. So, right. And then Florida, I mean, they're going to be voting on that in November, but they need over 60%. And that's hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they could get it, but it's
hard.
That's a high bar. Yeah.
Yes, it's a high bar. So I've heard some people talking about the ballot initiatives like, oh, you know, we don't have to worry about this that much. This is just going to restore things to the way that they were. But it's a lot more complicated than that, I think.
Let's maybe do a reality check now at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
Harris has said that she wants to enshrine abortion protections into federal law. It's a little bit less clear what Trump would do if elected, as you mentioned, but the reality is we have an extremely divided Congress. It seems highly unlikely that any kind of federal legislation on abortion access would pass. So if elected, what could Harris or Trump do?
It's a really good question. And I do think, I mean, sometimes I get frustrated with all the conversation about national abortion ban because it's just not, I mean, in either way, enshrining it or banning it on a federal level, I mean, it's just not going to happen. They just don't
seem impossible.
They really do. You know, unless something massive changes in the makeup of Congress and the Senate. So I'm glad you asked about other things that they can do, because that is what I think the conversation should be had around, because there is a lot that Trump could do to further restrict abortion, you know, just through federal agencies. So I'll give you a couple of examples. And a lot of this was outlined in Project 2025, the document that was put together by the Heritage Foundation. The key agency, I would say, to watch would be Health and Human Services. So they could make the abortion pill, which is used in over 50% of abortions nationwide, much harder to get. So they could stop it from being mailed, which is, you know, the way that it is getting to women in banned states right now. But they also could go so far as to have the FDA reconsider the initial 2000 approval of mifepristone, which is one of the two drugs that is used in the two-drug regimen. So if they really went, you know, full speed on this, it would make abortion much more difficult to access in all 50 states.
Mm.
So, there is a variety of things that they could do. You know, revoking the initial approval is the most extreme, but there are other restrictions that they could put on that drug that would affect everyone in the country and would be extremely disruptive to abortion access in general.
Yeah. Caroline, your reporting over these years has done such an excellent job of demonstrating that abortion care is healthcare, not just some political football. And yet it is unignorable that abortion is a big political issue right now in this country. How do you think about the way that we talk about healthcare and talk about these stories and the way that you report on it as a journalist and the way that we all talk about and think about these stories as people who read about the news?
Well, I do think that the way in which abortion is politicized really lends itself to a certain type of story being elevated. And it also lends itself to a simplification of these stories that are often very complex. And I do think that because politicians are really latching on to these stories, they are simplified to fit the political narrative sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that I love writing about this issue so much is that it is really complex. And there's a lot of complicated feelings. And it's a really hard decision. And it's often not black and white. One of my favorite stories that I have ever written on the topic was about a woman who was deterred from having an abortion because of the Texas abortion ban right when it took effect. She's 18 years old and ended up, because of the ban, having twins. And she has really complicated feelings about this law because she had to give up so much. She had to drop out of school, and her life is totally different. And her, you know, now husband's life is totally different. But she does love her babies and is glad that they're here. And so I tell that story because it's a illustration of how complicated and nuanced this issue can be. And I do think that because it's so politicized, sometimes we lose some of that nuance.
Caroline, thanks for bringing us all that nuance. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can read Caroline Kitchener's reporting for The Washington Post on Apple News. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.